Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today is Jared Wayland from Ontario, Canada. Jared is a graphic designer with SMA, who's also done different kind of advocacy work with SMA My Way. And he is a husband and father and a big music guru. So Jared, really glad to have you on today and excited to hear your story.
Thanks for having me, Kev. I'm excited to be here finally.
Absolutely. I know we connected on social media and I know a little bit, but I'm really excited to get to know you more here. So Jared, to start off, if you could just give listeners just a little bit about yourself and about your story growing up with SMA.
Sure. As you already touched on, I'm a graphic designer by trade. I am 35, almost 36 years old, living in the beautiful Great White North known as Canada. And I'll jump right into it. I got diagnosed with SMA when I was about 13 years old. We noticed that when I was playing sports like hockey, if I get knocked down, it was a little harder for me to get up, things like that. And then eventually, somewhere in that time frame, I think I was out with my grandparents, actually, and I was holding a CD or something like that. And they noticed that I had a tremor in my hand, which they're like, oh, like you're shaking. So anyway, one thing led to another. We end up getting referred to a neurologist by our family doctor locally. And then, which was not a nice experience as a 13-year-old, she had one of the worst bedside manners I've seen in a doctor. It was basically, okay, I think you have some form of muscular dystrophy. Here's a pamphlet on it. And this is what your life is going to be like. Obviously, she then referred me to a specialist in the province where we started to learn quite a bit more about it and that it wasn't everything that she just showed us in this pamphlet. And I stayed with that doctor up until I think about 3 years ago, and now I have a new specialist and who specializes actually in adults with SMA, which is kind of something that I think has been missing in a lot of places. And here we are, 35 years old. I got married in 2022 to my beautiful wife Sydney, and in January of the same year. Wait, I mixed up the order. We actually had a baby before we got married. We had a baby in January. We got married in May. So I've got a just over 2-year-old running around the house.
That's awesome, man. Congrats.
Thanks.
Absolutely. And scaling back just a sec. So, you know, this is a conversation I've had with people who were diagnosed later. Like, you know, for me, I'm type 2. I was diagnosed like 18 months. So I don't really have the before and after story. But I know obviously my parents do. And I have 2 older siblings who don't have SMA, so it was new for them. But for me, you know, this is all I've ever known. Okay, so for you, you're 13 and you're getting diagnosed with this neuromuscular condition that, especially at that time, not a lot is known about. How did that impact you from, you know, just a mental standpoint? And, you know, were you thinking long-term effects? What was kind of your mindset at that point?
Like I just said, like I was a pretty active kid. I played golf, I played hockey, I played baseball, I played all the things. Up until then, a pretty normal childhood, I would say, a great childhood. And that experience getting diagnosed, as I just touched on, it was, I don't even know if I can use the word devastating, because I don't think I knew what devastating really was at 13, to be honest with you, but it was shocking. I think looking back on it, my parents probably were more shocked than I was at the time. I don't think I could really process it at 13, to be honest with you. Wasn't really thinking long-term because the internet was just kind of coming up in its infancy, right? Like we didn't have all these awesome SMA resources we have now where you can just go find out people's stories and find out what to expect or what not to expect, things like that. But it was shocking. And I think it probably took a few years for it to really sink in, because I got diagnosed and I kept playing these sports or trying to play these sports. And over the year or two or three, those got more and more difficult, which so I, there was a point where I had to stop playing hockey, right? So that was hard for somebody who liked to play hockey. There was a point I had to stop playing golf. That was hard. And then along with all of that came this transition into puberty and into going to a new school, like a secondary school, things like that. And then all of a sudden it was, oh, like I walk a little differently, or I get up from a seat a little differently. And at 13, 14, 15, 16, I mean, hell, at 25, there's a lot of people who just don't get that. And there was a lot of questions. I mean, I would be lying if I said there wasn't a fair amount of bullying, a fair amount of things like that, which at one point I had to change schools between my 7th grade and 8th grade because my 7th grade school actually wouldn't accommodate my classes and put them all on the lower level, which now would almost be unheard of a school to do that, right? But yeah, so there was that, and then meeting a whole new group of friends when you're 15, trying to fit into these cliques that have already formed before you get there, and kind of being like the odd man out. And then you get to high school, you get to grade 9, 10, 11, 12, and I'll say I don't think kids are any more mature in high school than they are in elementary school, really, like in that regard. And then at some point, I ended up having to walk with a cane, and I was ambulatory until 2017 with my cane.
Okay.
And we can touch on that later, but I had a fall and I broke a couple bones, and that was kind of game over for me in the walking department.
I definitely want to talk about that in a bit. And then, but first, so you get into high school and middle school, I mean, we all know it's just like a nightmare for everyone. And when you add, transitioning to becoming a disabled person on top of it. But I want to get into, you as a music guru, because, you talked about sports and everything, and then having to not necessarily steer away from that, but adapt in that fashion. But what role did music play? Because you even said you were like holding a CD when like going to that appointment. Yeah, so talk to me about that. And was that a big coping mechanism? And was that something you were pursuing also?
So I took bass lessons and guitar lessons kind of on and off until probably I think 16 or 17, when I really found that the strength in my fingers was becoming an issue. Holding the pick was becoming an issue. Holding a guitar that weighs 5, 6 pounds was becoming an issue. And I got to high school and I played in a couple, like we'll call them garage bands, local garage bands, things like that. But what I also did was I was a promoter for local shows. So I put on a lot of concerts of local bands and even some touring bands that came through throughout high school. And that was kind of a really nice escape for me at that age. I was here, I am 16, 17, essentially running my own little business out of my house, putting on these shows, booking tours, booking bands. And I really found my community in that. I found my community in other musicians and just people who liked attending shows and volunteers who wanted to help out at shows. And a lot of it was probably based more in like the, we'll call it the punk rock world. And the thing I love about that punk rock world is everybody's kind of an outcast. Everybody is pretty open about it as well. And it didn't take me long to really kind of find my people.
It's funny you mentioned this because this is kind of a side note, but like a podcast I listen to religiously every week is Chris Gethard's Beautiful Anonymous, and he's a huge punk rocker. And he had another guest recently who was talking about that exact same thing about like he got into that scene more as an adult and they were sharing experiences. But like for Gethard, yeah, he got into it as a teenager and it was this transformative experience. And I think you met and in I think it's like for me, I was a theater kid. So that was a big part of finding community there. But yeah, it's like when you are, especially when you're transitioning to becoming a disabled person and you're grappling with all that, finding that community where, like you said, it's where everyone feels like an outsider in some way and you come together. It's just a really cool connection and vibe.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I mean, there's so many people from that community that I still stay in touch with, and I'm still really good friends with. And I mean, that being said, I kept a lot of my friends from, we'll call it pre-diagnosis. And that's been great too. But I mean, that's probably only one, two, three people, right? Like the people that I could really confide in when this was going on that I knew were my best friends. But yeah, a lot of my people kind of came from that music world, that punk rock world. And even today, like I'm a 35-year-old dad going to punk rock shows, and there's so many other 30, 40-year-old punk rock dads, punk rock moms, all with like their kids in tow, and the kids are wearing the band shirts. And I mean, you're probably familiar with this. If you go to a concert or a play or whatever you're going to, we generally have our own little section, which is really nice. Generally pretty close to the stage, or generally a really good vantage point, generally. And you meet people there too, right? That kind of have the same interest as you, that are in not the same situation, but kind of the same ballpark as you. And it's nice to have that common ground.
Oh man, I was at a concert in DC last year, the 930 Club, and like the way that there were a couple other wheelchair users, and yeah, they put us like it was like right up front of the stage, just cut up because it was a standing room only venue. But they put us like literally right there. It was awesome.
Who did you
And
go
like
see?
that was Maya Hawk, which like I have a because like she's a, I mean, people of course know her from her acting, but she's an indie musician as well. And so like that, like yeah, I like a lot of that indie folk and then rock and pop and stuff. So but like so
Cool.
we'll talk after to get some recommendations to, from you, because you're I can see just from your record collection behind you, yeah, your knowledge is very extensive. So I want to get the yeah.
Let's not pump me up too much, but we'll try.
Hey, it's all right, I know. I mean you clearly have a love for it, but
I do. I do.
and then going back to your teen years, so like once you you did have your interests and everything, what were you thinking as you were getting toward the end of high school, what you wanted to do, and what what was your life like, in the years that followed?
That's a good one too. So I would say my whole teenage life, I really wanted to be a chef. I love cooking. I loved watching cooking shows back in high school. I liked reading cooking books. But towards the end of high school, with the disease progressing and things like that, a chef wasn't necessarily maybe the smartest move for me. It's a lot of hours on your feet. It's a lot of running around in the kitchen. I mean, slippery surfaces on the floor when I was still walking, things like that, lots of heavy pots and pans. So I had to, at some point, I had to make a conscious choice, right? Like, do I kind of follow my passion, or do I try and find something else I'm interested in and see where that leads me? And I thought, hey, like I think I'd make a pretty good teacher. So I actually went to university for 2.5, 3 years for a history degree. I wanted to teach like elementary or high school history. And at the same time, like throughout high school, I had been a self-taught graphic designer, and had a couple buddies that did it as well. And one summer while I was in university, I actually got a job working at a print shop, doing like car wraps and vinyl wraps and posters and things like that. And the same time, like whenever I'd put on these shows in high school, I'd always do my own posters or advertisements or whatever. I worked like a week in that print shop that summer, and I said, this is what I want to do. So I actually didn't go back to university. I still have some parts of my degree lingering somewhere out there. And I just stuck around. I think I worked there for another couple of years and freelanced on the side and picked up little gigs where I could, and just kind of honed in on what I thought I was good at. And yeah, that led me, I guess, eventually to where I am today, working at a couple of fairly big marketing agencies. And yeah, now I'm on a, I don't know, year six or year seven of a contract with a company in Massachusetts, running their design team and all of that. So
And were you always in Ontario?
Yeah, I've always been Ontario, St. Catharines, Ontario, born and raised. About
Very cool.
10
Yeah.
minutes, about 10 minutes from Niagara Falls for people who don't know.
Okay, very cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so that,
Yeah.
yeah, it's crazy. So it's like you had headlight, and then it was just sort of by chance, or just, you were there and realized, oh, wow, this is actually what I want to do.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever actually like worked in that environment with other people who were also doing the same thing. I was always at home or in my room or whatever, doing stuff on my own. And then you find this again, it's like kind of finding your people, right? Again, and you find these people who are doing the same thing, who can make you better, who can teach you things. And yeah, just it really kind of snowballed from there without a real plan in place, if I'm being honest.
That's, I mean, sometimes that's how it is. It's just like you never know when passions like that are going to come about or be discovered. And for you, I think it sounded like it was sort of like a culmination of everything that you were interested in and just fell into the right place.
Yeah, and I'm like, I consider myself, and I think most people that know me would, I'm a pretty outgoing person. So it doesn't matter where we are, I'm talking to people, I'm meeting new friends, I'm all of that. And so that I think also helped me, not only with my career, but I think just as a whole, right? Like you talk to enough people, you can kind of figure out how to weed out the ones that you don't want to talk to.
That's absolutely, well, it's just like you discover your real friends like as you get older and all those things. But that's awesome.
100%.
Yeah, that's awesome that you found that passion. And okay, so going back to the disability progression and you said you talked about how you were using a cane for a long time and then eventually transitioned to a chair. So, well, first question is, so did you need any kind of caregivers during that time when you were still ambulatory, like with any kind of like physical tasks, or were you getting around kind of on your own?
So I lived at home with my parents and my two siblings. None of them are disabled. And so they were my core support system, right? They were my caregivers. Let's put it that way. I couldn't climb stairs after probably 13 or 14. So we moved me down to the main level, and they put an addition on their house for me, things like that, which was fantastic at the time to have such a supportive family around me. And then where are we going with this again?
I wouldn't know. Just I was just talking about. Okay, so that's where I would, like if you needed any kind of care at that
Right.
point while you were still ambulatory, and
Yeah,
also, well,
so
also like you said you have two siblings. Are you on the younger, older, middle?
I'm the oldest of three.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so
So,
I'm the youngest, so that's why I was curious too. And same thing, my brother and sister both don't have SMA. But
Right.
yeah.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, it's definitely an interesting dynamic, and it was new ground for everybody, really. Like we didn't really have much lived disability experience as a family. So you kind of live and learn. And yeah, like there were obviously a lot of things around the house I needed help with, whether, I don't know, it was getting something from upstairs or getting pots and pans out of a cupboard or getting something from downstairs, things like that. But I was also pretty lucky that my parents kind of let me figure it out on my own, basically as long as I was okay. They were, I've got a really close relationship with them, so they always knew where I was, who I was with, things like that. But really, they kind of let me, I guess, find myself. We'll call it that way. And so, yeah, we had a few tasks, like a few little things like that, that they would help out with, and obviously emotionally to help out as well as anybody could who's new to that situation, right? And like I said, the internet was new, and I remember, like, my mom still talks about it, is that like our doctor was like, oh, we'll connect you with this other family that has SMA, and they were in Texas, and like you had to communicate by email, and they were significantly older than me, and I don't think I knew anybody around here with SMA until at least in my 20s, because there was just nothing, there's no resources on it. There was no guidance on how to find those people, like anything like that. So yeah, that was, and then I think at like 17 or 18, I actually did end up getting my driver's license for a couple years. I had like an adaptive transmission so that I didn't have to pull down on the transmission or push the transmission. But I still had a bit of mobility in my feet, so I was driving. And long story short, a few years later, I was like, you know what, this is getting too hard now. Just like everything else I had before kind of progresses. And I was like, it's probably not safe that I'm driving. So I haven't driven in probably like 10, almost 10 years now.
Okay, yeah, that's a, yeah, and yeah, it's one of those things I never attempted myself, but I know there's adaptive with, but yeah, it's like anything you do, you just kind of adapt as you go along. And
Right.
then, yeah, okay, and then you, okay, so you said in 2017 you had the fall, and then that's what led you to transitioning to a wheelchair. So let's talk about that.
Sure. So like leading up, like from, let's call it like 20 to 20, I gotta do some quick math here, to 28, 29.
Okay, yeah.
I was pretty active socially. Like I'd go out with my friends, obviously couldn't climb stairs, but really didn't let that deter me. They'd throw me over the shoulder and fireman carry me up to wherever I had to go, made sure I was kind of propped up in a corner or on a bar or whatever, just so that I had something to hold on to. And that was good. And again, like my friends have all been fantastic through the whole journey as well. And then, yeah, it was 2017, September 2017. I was still walking with a cane, things like that. I had just met my now wife, I don't know, 4 months earlier, which
Okay.
is a whole other thing is about dating with this and
We'll definitely
whatnot.
talk about
But
that. Yeah, absolutely.
and so yeah, we were I was walking in my room the one day. I think I was just going to the bathroom or something and took a wrong step and went down like a sack of potatoes. I basically fell on my leg. I broke my tibia and my fibula. And ended up essentially on bed rest for September, October, November, like 6 months until I could get into a rehab facility to try and regain some walking again, which was also an interesting experience because they didn't really have experience with dealing with somebody with a neuromuscular disease, and so they're treating me almost as if I'd been in an accident. It's like, oh, this is how we would progress everybody to get back to walking. And unfortunately, after I'd been in bed for 6 months, I think the damage had for the most part already been done, right? Like that's a long time to go, especially when I had been standing and been mobile a little bit and things like that, to go completely immobile. And actually, that's to touch on the other thing, that was kind of my first experience with caregivers for some of that, which didn't last very long. Didn't really like people in my house. Didn't like people I didn't know taking care of me. My wife has been my primary caregiver since. But yeah, so that was it. And then ended up going to rehab. Kind of walked. I don't know if I'd even call it walk. I couldn't do it without holding on to somebody. And then it was honestly, it was, I can't tell you a day, but it was like a week, and it was just like, I'm really tired this week, and that was kind of the end of me walking. It wasn't like a thing that happened that stopped me from walking one day or stopped me from being able to support my body weight standing up. It was just like, this is, I can't do it anymore. And that's where we are now. So I've been in that chair since, I don't know, let's say like late 2018, mid 2018, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And I had a little experience using one before because if we were going long distances or something like a concert or a hockey game or any sporting event or whatever, I couldn't walk that far anyway. So we would take a travel chair with us, and then when I got to my seat or the place we had to be, I'd usually stand and kind of stay standing as long as I could. But yeah, so and now I am in a power chair. I've been in a power chair since 2020, and I love it. It's fantastic.
That's what I was
Giving
about
me
to
a
ask. So, because I was gonna, so like, I've talked to other, type threes who are also, have more physical transition to chairs much later in life, and not across the border, but for a lot of them that I've talked to, they've said that they were reluctant to transition for a long time, but once they did, they found it very liberating because it did save so much energy, and they realized, oh, this is actually going to make me more independent rather than feel like a loss.
Yeah, and I think like hindsight's a really good thing in a situation like this, right? Like I fell and broke my leg. Probably one of the better things or most important things that's actually happened to me. Because who like I don't really know how long I would have gone trying to walk and trying to stay upright. And who knows what could have happened, right? I could have had a more serious fall. I could have hit my head. I could have fallen down the stairs. There's a lot of what ifs in that case. And so that kind of forced my hand to get comfortable using a chair, which I was 100%, I agree with you. I was definitely reluctant to do before. I was embarrassed. And that kind of forced my hand into it. And that was kind of the beginning of like almost a new me, really. Like I didn't realize how much I was going to gain down the line from losing that ability to walk.
Sure, it totally changes you, and again, it's not the transition part is not something I can relate to as much because again, I've been in a power chair since like before preschool, so it's a different experience. But I'm always curious to hear what it is like, the mental and emotional journey, and how it is for you now too.
Yeah, it's sorry, I just had to respond
No
to a
worries. Go
text
ahead.
there.
Yeah, no worries.
No, we're good. Yeah, so it can you just repeat that question again? Sorry, Kev.
No, I was just saying, like, I'm always curious, having not really gone through that transition process specifically, of like what it's like mentally and emotionally, and how you're doing now, since all that has happened.
I mean, mentally, it's as hard as it can get. I don't know. It's really hard. It's everything you're used to is either gone or done significantly differently. I mean, 4 months into a new relationship, I was worried that it was going to change my then girlfriend's perspective on me. And oh, there's way more care involved than I signed up for. So kind of see you later, which was basically my dating experience up until that point. And I think I'm still a work in progress. Like I'd be lying if I said that I've gotten everything figured out. Every day there's some kind of new challenge, or every day there's some kind of new issue or barrier or whatever, and you have to become really good at adapting in our situation, I think, and you have to also be okay with adapting. Because if you I really believe that, like it took me it like I said, it's a work in progress. So it's taken me till now to get fully comfortable with myself. I'm as comfortable with myself today as I ever will be, and I was probably less comfortable with myself yesterday, and I'll be more comfortable tomorrow. But you like it's easy to say like don't sweat the small stuff or anything like that, but like I'm the same person at the end of the day. And whether other people can see that or whether other people look at me differently, that's their problem. And that's one of the big things that I've kind of done is just I'm really good at letting things roll down my back. And listen, if I'm comfortable enough with myself, then kind of whatever else is thrown at me, we'll just kind of deal with it.
Man, 100%. And I think that's something, all of us in disability communities deal with, and really anyone too. I mean, it's just I think it's human nature to be so concerned about how others perceive ourselves, and then come to the realization, no, it's more about what we think of ourselves and how we can, adapt day in, day
Right,
out.
and it's kind of goes back to that punk rock attitude of like
Yeah.
I don't give a shit. I don't know if I'm
Yeah.
allowed to say that on the podcast, but
You're good,
I
man.
don't care. I don't care. Like it's I've got me, I've got my people, I've got my life going on. I don't have the time or brain space to worry about what other people think of me.
Absolutely. Well, and speaking of that, so you transitioned perfectly with talking about dating life. Okay, so you met said that prior to meeting your now wife, you did have that kind of like just bumps in the road, and I think it sounds like struggling to embrace like yourself and everything. But so okay, so for what was your dating life like You know, they're already 20 and stuff. It's okay, no shame. I have plenty of, and then
Perfect.
we'll talk about meeting your wife after that.
It was terrible. Well, I tried to date it. Like, I tried to be as normal as a kid through high school and university as I could. Like that, and I mean, I dated a few girls here and there. Some of them lasted a month, some of them lasted a day, some of them lasted a year, some of them lasted 2 years, like things like that. But at the end of the day, I don't know. I don't know exactly what they're thinking, but I think like being that young and being that kind of naive to things, I don't think I met somebody who was open-minded enough at the time. Because at the same time, they've all got their own teenage and early adult lives going on, right? And their
Sure.
experience, while it's the same, is also vastly different than mine physically. So yeah, there's a lot of road bumps like that. And I mean, I tried everything that I'm sure everybody has, like from just like meeting people organically to eventually when they came out, like the dating apps like Tinder and stuff like that. And looking back on it, I think one of the things that I could have done better, and I probably should have done better, is be more upfront about my situation and be more open about my situation. I think I tried to just kind of push it in the back and, oh, you know, I'm living this normal life of a 18, 19, 20-year-old, whatever. Because I found out that once I did open myself up a little more, I mean, I had dated a girl and it didn't work out, and I said, okay, you know what? That's it for me. Like, I'm kind of, I guess I'm gonna be stuck in my parents' house. They're gonna be caring for me until I'm too old and they can't care for me. And then where do you go, right? You kind of fall through the cracks, or one of my siblings would have to do, I don't know. I really don't know. And so I kind of said, you know what? That's it. I'm done with dating apps. I'm done with whatever. I'm a single guy, and I'm kind of starting to come to peace with it with myself, right? And I don't know what made me do it. One day I'm probably sitting on the toilet or something, and put Tinder back on my phone, and I don't know, had a couple matches, conversations didn't really go anywhere, didn't really find anybody to open up to, until I started talking to this one girl. And I don't know, something about the conversation or that day, or my mind that day, maybe I worked myself to a point where I'm like, okay, you know what? I've got to just put my whole self out there, kind of thing. And I was pretty upfront with her about everything when we were talking. I'm like, this is me. This is kind of what you're gonna get on a date. Like, my dad's gonna drop me off because I don't drive, and I can't have you pick me up because I can't get out of your car because it's too low. So I'll meet you at the bar. And we met, and the date went really well. I thought it went well for both of us. We both had a lot of fun. Actually, our first date, I don't know, probably like 8 or 10 of my friends showed up at the same bar for one of my other friends' birthdays. So you can imagine the ribbing that I got a little bit there, and all of that. But I mean, I think that helped too, because it kind of showed her that I have this whole community around me that can kind of see me for what I am, I guess, right? As whatever that sounds. But yeah, fast forward a couple more dates, things went well, we became official or whatever. We started courting, as they said in the 1600s. And she's now my wife. And again, like, that's 20, I met her in 2017, so we're at like 7 or 8 years now. And yeah, I mean, big learning curve for both of us. Massive learning curve every day.
Totally. Well, and I mean, you know, it's quite a curveball throughout. You know, like you start this, it's going great, and then to have your accident that early on in your relationship, I imagine. I mean, just speaking, like I would be pretty terrified that even if the person was cool, that might scare them away. But like that, I think is a true testament to like you know, I think her character and that and the relationship you have that. Oh, you had this massive challenge thrown your way, and you're like, "Well, no." I mean, I'm sure it wasn't easy, but that proved that you were compatible
Yeah.
for each other, you know?
And I mean, like, that was it. Like, I remember was sitting outside with my broken leg, and we were hanging out, and I'm in my head, I'm just like, okay, like, just kind of enjoy this while you can, because it's probably not gonna last. And then I did a couple months of rehab at like an inpatient hospital, so I had to stay there for a couple months, and that was probably the most challenging part for the both of us. I think she'll say the same thing, because she wanted to help, she wanted to be there, she came and visited every day, that kind of stuff. She wanted to do what I needed, but I didn't want to let her in and do that, because I was like, oh, that will even scare her away even more, right? If she's got to help me with things that nobody's really helped me with before, like whether that's going to the bathroom or getting into bed or like bathing me, essentially, like things like that, right? I'm like, this is just like, this is not good. And yeah, that was tough. That was a tough couple months for both of us. But we got out of it, and I eventually opened myself up, because she was so willing to help and so willing to be there and wanted to be one of my main pillars of support. And I was like, okay, this is kind of for real now. This is getting a little serious. And I think 2 days after I got out of the hospital, we went on our first trip together to Boston. Like, we flew to Boston. And so that's a whole other learning curve, right? Of going away together, hotel room, it's not your normal bathroom, it's not your normal bed, it's not your normal city, all that stuff. And yeah, really, like, honestly, smooth sailing ever since. Obviously challenges, like, no different than anybody else has in a relationship, able body or not. We're there for each other. And I don't know, I think it was Dr. Phil or whatever, was kind of, people were on there about like caregiving and relationships, and I heard a good quote. I don't think it was him that actually said it, but 100% of relationships involve caregiving, right? Like, there's a care there, whether that's physical care for a disabled person or just giving care to the other person, like, that's what
Well,
happens.
it was so the Dr. Phil quote was like he got a lot of pushback from this because he was saying that it doesn't work for interracial couples who have like their caregiver as their spouse be their caregiver. And so there was obviously a lot of backlash to that because like because it's something different. There are interracial couples who they keep caregiving separate, others who their significant other is their primary caregiver. Others where it's kind of a balance, but yeah. But I mean, totally. I think it's just it's always gonna be a factor. And even if like someone with SMA has other caregivers helping them, their spouse, significant other is still gonna be there for a lot of support and a lot of day-to-day stuff. And but it's really
Yeah.
cool that you both have stayed together and. Like had that mutual respect for each other.
Yeah, and that's it. Like, I mean, it's a fine line, right? Like, there are things I don't want her to do or have to do, but I need that done, right? And vice versa. I like any relationship, like, it might not look like let's say a typical able-bodied relationship where the wife cooks and cleans, traditional relationship where the wife cooks and cleans and does the dishes and things like that, and I'm doing the hard work outside and carrying all the heavy things and doing all the manual labor, because it's really a flip on that when you think about it. I try and help out with the, I don't know, we'll call it the house administration as much as I can. I kind of take care of all that. I make sure the appointments are booked. I make sure that everybody's where they need to be on time, all of that stuff. And then a lot of the physical stuff comes to her, right? So we're a pretty good team, and we can kind of throw things to each other when we need to, and we can depend on one another to have the other one's back and to help the other one in whatever way they need help, be it physical or emotional or mental or whatever.
Absolutely. I love that. And
Yeah.
yeah, well, and I know we're kind of like running short on time. I could talk with you all day about all this stuff,
Okay.
I think a good way to kind of like close it, can you talk a little bit about also being a father and just kind of your family's day-to-day life?
Sure. So, like I said, we decided that we wanted to be parents. I think probably relatively early on into our relationship getting serious. Like once we knew that we wanted to stay together and stuff like that. Obviously, you have to have the conversation of, do you want kids? Like, what are you thinking? I always wanted to be a dad. I had a great dad growing up. She had a great dad growing up. And I was like, that would be just so fun. I didn't know how it would look. I didn't know how I would do that. I didn't know if my child would have SMA. So one of the first things that we actually did was get genetic testing done. She's not a carrier. Our child basically had no chance of from us of having SMA. And that we went into that appointment knowing that whatever came back to us, like the just like whatever the doctor said and whatever the genetic testing said, that wouldn't have any bearing on our want to have a child. We would have done it either way, where I know a lot of people go into that and they say, oh, I can't have a disabled child because I'm disabled, or even if they're not, they whatever. But yeah, so we kind of decided that, and yeah, January 2022, our son was born. The day after New Year's Day, she went into labor actually on New Year's Eve, and then had a quite a long labor at the hospital on like the snowiest day that I've seen in a long time. So, I mean, there's a whole other thing, right? Like, how do I get to the hospital? How do I even get to the van because it's so snowy? Things like that. But we did it, and yeah, here we are, and it's been I think the best decision that either of us have made. We love him so much. He's a ball of energy. He exhausts me, but in the best possible way. And we try and parent, I guess we'll call it, I hate using the term, but as normal as possible. I do think that we have a little different perspective on things because of our interabled relationship and because of my situation and all of that. So I think that is beneficial to a child growing up in your house as well. And yeah, we really just want to see him grow and see what kind of person he becomes, and see, my wife is quite an introverted person. I'm quite the opposite. So I don't know which way he's gonna go yet. I think he's a little more on the quiet side. But I mean, he loves his music. He loves playing hockey with his toy hockey sticks. His mom is super active, so like he loves going outside with her for walks, for runs. He loves climbing, he loves jumping, all of that stuff. So I mean, if he can get the best of both of us, then that's great. And yeah, but I don't know. I think we're just super excited to see him, what he becomes and what he wants to do. And I mean, every day watching him develop more and more into like a little human is crazy. I never thought I'd be here. I never thought I'd be a parent. I said I thought I might be stuck at my parents' house, and I don't know, one right sleep, and here we are. And yeah, it's awesome. I'm sure you can see, like right now, I can't stop smiling when I talk about it. It's just so much fun. And like we've been able to take him to a couple concerts and do all this stuff that we like to do. And so just integrating into our lives as much as possible and centering our lives around him as much as possible right now, because I mean, you're only young once, right? So we'd like to enjoy all of this. And I mean, you have a kid and you kind of lose contact with a few people, or your lives are kind of going in different ways and stuff. But again, like that whole support group of our family and our friends that's kind of been around since day one, like they're all still here, and it's great. And a lot of our friends have kids and they can play together. And yeah, it's just it was a great choice. It was the best choice I ever made.
Man, I love it. I was really happy for And I think that's great encouragement to people out there in our community who may be in that stage that you once were and not really sure what's next. There's definitely hope.
Yeah, there's definitely hope, and I mean the reality of it is you're not really sure what's next, right? And that's not even for us, it's not even for just disabled people, it's for anybody. Like, just, I don't know. Sounds so cliche again, but like, seize the moment, seize the day. Like, take one day at a time and enjoy it. And yeah.
Carpe diem. Yeah.
Carpe diem.
I'm a big Dead Toilet Society fan, so that's a perfect note
Beautiful,
to end on. Yeah.
beautiful.
I love it. Well, Jared, this has been great and I would, love to talk more. But where for now, where can people find you on social media?
Sure. So I basically just use Instagram. I kind of, my Facebook, I just keep quite personal, but Instagram at Jared, JaredWay, Jared Way. That's where you'll find me. That's where you'll find me zipping around on my chair. That's where you'll find me doing some advocacy work here and there. Mostly you'll just find my record collection and me going to concerts. But yeah, that's where I am. And I think I'm an all right follow. I'll shoot me a message, reach out if anybody has questions. Pick my brain. I'm an open book. Like, that's if I can give my experience, or if my experience can help somebody, or give them a little boost or whatever, then that's great.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Ben. And no, I can testify. We follow each other. Definitely go check it out. And there's a lot of great record collections and everything on there. I love it.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for having me, Kev. This has been fun.
Oh, thank you very much. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on social media and our forums and follow smanewstoday.com for all the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.